Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, entertainment, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and, well, whatever else might come along. I have a science lesson coming up for you, a little bit of contrary to popular opinion about folic acid, and I want to welcome you. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start out with just a little email. This one from Angelina in Aptos. On the subject of plastic, dear Dr. Dawn, I had hernia surgery and requested not to have the mesh, though I later found out that the stitches were made of a type of plastic and left inside the body. I'm wondering if this plastic is as bad for me as plastic bottles. I'm someone who tries to avoid plastic, and I want to know if I should be concerned. Well, Angelina, I'm happy to tell you that there is no bisphenol A in the nylon sutures that are used in most surgeries. So I think very likely there's nothing for you to be worried about. One has to look in terms of who's at risk and what the risk-benefit ratios are. And with respect to something like bisphenol A, it's a matter of volume and degree and also just the fact that we see changes that are disturbing that have made us really focus on this compound. And it's really important not to generalize to a completely global freak out about plastic in general. That's not what I'm trying to do by informing people. I'm hopefully following a more middle way. Anyway, I want to assure you that compared to the risks of walking around with an untreated hernia, any even remotely theoretical risk of having a small amount of nylon suture material in your body is simply not worth worrying about. Hopefully that will help you feel a little bit better about the whole thing. Let's take another email. This one, Tamara in Salinas. Tamara writes, my husband, age 63, has a tear in his rotator cuff, which is 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. He did weightlifting back in October. It was bothering him quite a bit, mainly at night, but that's lessened considerably. I'm wondering whether this tear can repair itself. If he does nothing about it, will it be a recurring problem? And do you recommend surgery? Well, Tamara, first of all, I want to say that rotator cuff is a structure in the shoulder, which is composed of the ligaments of several muscles. And these are responsible for lifting and moving back and forth the shoulder. And also, because the shoulder is actually capable of rotating, if you stick your arm straight up to the side, palms down, and then turn your palm up, you can do almost a 180. And that's all happening in the rotator cuff. And as that happens, it's almost like a door hinge. And there are two bony prominences that need to pass by each other, and between those bony prominences, there's a ligament and a structural item called a bursa, which is kind of a gel pad that acts as a lubricant. Now, when a person has repetitive strain of the shoulder, which they can get from over-exercising, they will develop bursitis, and that inflammation causes it to be painful when you lift or rotate the arm. We have a symbol we use in medicine called the gladiator sign, where you have your thumb up, and just like the old emperors in the Roman times, you turn your thumb down, and that means the gladiator dies. Well, if you do that move and it hurts, we call that a positive gladiator sign, and it's a sign of either bursitis or inflammation in the rotator cuff. Now, because that clearance is very small, over time, the tendons can get worn through, and they can get frayed, and then a sudden sharp movement or a fall on an outstretched arm can actually cause them to rupture completely. Now, a completely ruptured rotator cuff is very disabling and does need surgical repair. If it's only a partial tear, however, many people find that as the inflammation improves over several weeks to a month, that they no longer have much pain. So the question then for your husband is, Does he have a full range of motion? Is he able to reach up in the same angles with both arms? And if he is, and he can do that pain-free, then in my opinion, he does not require surgery. He does need to be careful not to aggravate it, and probably should do some physical therapy to strengthen the muscles of the back and stretch the muscles of the chest to prevent further problems. We're going to try to get Linda in Monterey. Hello, Linda, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I wanted to know, please, we have a high deductible HSA account right now. I'm 57, my husband's 58, and they're raising their rates 30%. Mm. So we're thinking of either going there or getting like four or five different accident-only insurance policies because they're only to $25,000, or just self-insuring, but we are a bit concerned because we do own our own home and have investment and retirement accounts. I just kind of want to get your thoughts on all that.
Well, basically, have you looked around for other disaster insurance, major medical type policies, maybe with a higher deductible?
Well, yes, we did. We're considering a 10,000, 20,000 family.
Yeah, I think that basically you've got a long way to go before Medicare.
Yeah.
And if you let the insurance drop, well, we don't know what's going to come out through Congress.
Right.
All right. And until you know for sure that you don't become a medical leper when you get melanoma next year, and it's early, and they cure you, but now you're a cancer patient, and you're 58, and you are an insurance leper, and they don't have to take you back, and they won't.
Yeah.
So as long as the insurance companies can get away with that kind of insanity, and that's what it is, it's completely insane, people like yourself pay the price. This is atrocious and outrageous, but it is the status quo. We just got to see how difficult it is to change the status quo, no matter how outrageous and atrocious it is. And I won't get on my soapbox. I'm going to stay with you, so don't panic, don't fear. So in your situation, your best move is to try and keep your costs down. You are gambling if you don't pay, if you don't go with the insurance that covers you between your high deductible HSA and you leave yourself a $10,000 gap. Okay, you probably could generate $10,000 from a home equity loan or something like that. And yeah, it would hurt, but it wouldn't put your long-term financial security at risk.
Right.
And you would still have, under most circumstances, that safety net for your house and your investments. There are people who lose everything because they get a cancer diagnosis and they need a bone marrow transplant and they get, whatever, denied. Or, you know, in the case of certain insurance companies, they'll actually go back and data mine your application and try to find something you forgot to mention so they can accuse you of fraud and kick you off. There have been lawsuits, fines. It's completely proven that this sort of stuff goes on. So I don't want to see you setting yourself up for that. My thought is a real high major medical is much better than accident policies because those accident policies only work if there's an accident. And it doesn't help you if you develop a cancer. Like I said, colon cancer, you're over 50, so colon cancer, skin cancer, breast or cervical cancer, things that are not lethal because we can catch them early. But then you've got 10 years before the government steps in and allows you to be insured again.
Right. What about just running the odds of getting any of that? I mean, they're so small to the individual.
Yes, that's true. That's not a gamble I'm prepared to take myself. And
yeah.
I generally am pretty risk aversive. Ask my investment counselor or my financial planner, whatever he is. He'll say, oh yeah, she's real risk aversive. That's where I am on that spectrum. So you have to figure out where you are on that spectrum and decide, but you are rolling the dice and things can come up snake eyes for you.
Right. Okay, thank you, Dr. Don.
Wish I had a better answer.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. So let me talk to you a little bit about H1N1, particularly if you are pediatric or you have pediatric patients, I should say, in your household. We dodged a bullet on the H1N1. Swine flu or whatever you want to call it, this year, the virus became less aggressive, which is really good, and it didn't kill nearly as many people as it might have. And the number of people who got it was at the low end of the projections, which were still a great deal more flu than we normally see, but they generally had mild self-limited illnesses. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody died. I personally know of at least two patients in my practice who died of fulminant pneumonia who had H1N1 come up positive. And I'm sure that there were many more in this very community and everywhere else, just not the vast quantities that we had feared. Well, that's all to the good, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't get vaccinated. If you get vaccinated now, the epidemic has dropped. The rates of new cases have inflected down. That's good. It'll be back around next year. It's going to be in the environment. So it is important to get vaccinated. That way you will have some protection if it mutates again, which it can, when we really hope it doesn't, and becomes more aggressive. If you've already been vaccinated, the chances are you will have some immunity against the newer mutated form. So particularly for children, I want to urge you, if you have kids and they got one H1N1, have them get the second shot. It really isn't an unimportant bit of therapy. Now, something very interesting happened on vaccinations this week, something that almost never happens. The British journal Lancet actually formally retracted a study that was published back in 1998. And this study was the one spearheaded by Dr. Wakefield, which was the first study suggesting a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. It gave rise to a great panic, both in England and to a certain extent in the United States, and certainly added fuel to the fire of the vaccination, no vaccination controversy. It was like gasoline on a blaze as far as that's concerned. There's been a great deal of research done subsequently looking to find a link between vaccination and autism. Autism cases have definitely increased, and some of that is case finding, and some of it is something else. Most likely there is a something else here. But thimerosal, which is the mercury-containing preservative that was reputed to cause the autism, has been out of vaccines since 2001. And unfortunately, we haven't seen a drop, that persistent drop in autism cases. There was an inflection, and now autism continues to rise. And I honestly don't think it's all case finding. I think there is really something going on here. I have a middle way suggestion, and this is just a suggestion based on what we know about physiology. First of all, I suggest that we all accept that there is not a vast conspiracy out there to sell vaccinations, and that government entities and the industry and all of the scientists are lying because they have a profit motive here. I think that's a bit far-fetched. It's hard for large conspiracies to exist, and this one would be just not credible just on the basis of the organizational difficulties. Furthermore, I really think the scientific evidence is there that shows again and again that on any kind of sensible risk-benefit analysis that you choose to use, the risk of getting the disease and having a long-term complication from it far outweighs the risk of the vaccine. That being said, there are probably individuals who are uniquely vulnerable to vaccination, and we need to try to come up with ways to protect them. So here comes the modest proposal. One of the things that we do in pediatrics is when the child is there for their well child visits, we give them a lot of vaccines all at once. And that's done largely for the convenience of the doctor's office, and because we come from a sort of historical tradition of mass vaccination campaigns. What I would propose is that because our bodies are capable of dealing with small amounts of toxins and small amounts of preservatives very well, that we spread out the vaccination schedule. where possible, instead of giving a child 4 or 5 vaccinations at one of those early well child visits, why not give them 1, bring them back a week later, give them 2, and a week later and 3, and so on? And the main reason for this is just practical. People have difficulty organizing that in their offices. Parents have difficulty bringing their children in. So it isn't even thought of, but it's a practice that I and some of my colleagues have been instituting over the last several years. And to me, it seems the best solution to a very difficult problem. Seek to minimize the risk and still achieve the benefit. Give the body some time to deal with each vaccine and its preservative. We now have sophisticated electronic medical records. We can set up tickler files. And for that matter, most parents are in the position of doing lots of childcare, movement of their children, and chauffeuring of their children. And so they've worked their work lives such that bringing the kid in on a Saturday for a quick vaccination and then off to the market is not that hard to accomplish. Yes, it's a little bit more work, but if it makes the difference in my practice between a family agreeing to vaccinate their child or not, then I consider it well worth the effort. So a couple of interesting things came out in the research world this week, largely stuff about, you know, nothing actually works very well. A lot of what we do in medicine, if you subject it to a high level of scrutiny, placebo, double blind, and all of that, a lot of things don't work anyway. This research coming out of the Cochrane Database Systemic Review, which is an excellent service. The Cochrane Database basically looks at, is a therapy supported by the data? And they go and they do these massive meta-analyses of the medical literature. And this is another such published bit of research. And what these researchers did, and this is authored by Lockhart and Daly, and I will post a link to it on the website. I got this off of Medline. But looking at the treatment for Bell's palsy. Now, let me stop and tell you what Bell's palsy is. It's where the 7th cranial nerve, which is a motor nerve to your face, shuts down. It just goes offline. And that side of your face becomes paralyzed. From the eyebrow down, due to a little idiosyncrasy of the wiring of the cranial nerves onto the face. But in any event, what happens is the nerve stops working. The brain's working fine, sending the signal, the nerve, the cable is cut. So a person develops a facial paralysis, a facial droop. It looks like they've had a stroke. This has been associated with herpes simplex virus and herpes zoster and Lyme disease. And it's one of the things where if you see a Bell's palsy, you probably do want to check the person for Lyme disease if you're anywhere near a tick that carries Borrelia burgdorferi. It is one of the indications to get checked. But most of the time, it's actually due to activating herpes virus. And so the traditional treatment in medicine, certainly the treatment I was taught in medical school, is to use an anti-herpes drug like Zovirax and prednisone. So the Cochrane committee here decided we're going to look at that and see if, in fact, that helps or if it's better than placebo. So they found 7 trials that were almost 2,000 participants, which gives you decent statistical power. And what they were able to find was that if you compare antivirals to placebo, there's absolutely no difference between the two. If you add antivirals and corticosteroids together, you do see a slight improvement, but it's so minuscule from a risk-benefit standpoint, raises a question in my mind of whether the risk of the corticosteroid therapy is actually validated by this very, very small, but statistically significant difference. From a clinical standpoint, it's probably not worthwhile to treat Bell's palsy with either the acyclovir class of drugs or the corticosteroids. How long it will take for that to find its way into medicine, into standard medical practice, well, don't hold your breath, because it's very, very hard not to do something, especially when if your patient goes to the next doctor down the line, they'll probably be told to do exactly what you decided not to do, and patients tend to prefer to do something rather than nothing. Let's talk to Dan in Aromas. Hello, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Dr. Don. My wife said she suggested I call you. We both respect your opinions and thoughts. Last year, I was diagnosed with a type of cancer, and I've been going through regular Western medical treatments. And I have a lot of respect for the team there that I work with and the doctors and nurses. I'm just curious what kind of alternative treatments, adjunct therapies that you might talk about that might be helpful.
Well, it depends on the type of cancer.
Follicular lymphoma?
Follicular lymphoma. Okay, so for the audience, this is basically a bloodline cancer. It's a stem cell-derived cancer where you have a cancer in lymph tissue, and those can spread to other tissue as well. So they do have a tendency to metastasize. Have you had a bone marrow transplant, or is that in the works for you?
No, I'm not to that point. I really don't have a lot of symptoms except being a little tired. But so I had a huge mass, and I've been going through an antibody therapy, Rituxan.
Okay.
And I've been going to acupuncture, and I've been taking some mushroom mix herbs. And
okay. So let's start with the mushrooms, because the reishi and some of the other mushrooms, cordyceps is one, have really interesting data on anti-cancer effects. And this is good solid scientific data, both in animal models and in tissue culture. It's extremely difficult to prove benefit in actual cancer patients because cancer is so variable and there's so much comorbid disease that you can't get a large enough study where you isolate all the variables to really have clean statistics. And that's one of the challenges to clinical care and the derivation of solid cancer therapies. That being said, there's a principle of risk versus benefit, and risk of using these mushroom-derived compounds is extremely low, and the least suggestion of potential benefit is pretty good. So I definitely recommend the use of mushroom compounds for management of cancer. I think there's good data that it helps rev up the killer T cells and other aspects of cancer immune therapy, let's call it, your self-immunity against it. Now, with respect to antioxidants and things that are actively reduce reactive oxygen species, there's a great deal of controversy. And this would be like wheatgrass would be a classic example of an antioxidant that someone with cancer might wonder if they can take. I'm going to go on record here as saying that without any evidence to support my opinion, there's no evidence in either direction. I'm in favor of using antioxidants just on theoretical grounds, but most cancer doctors will say don't use antioxidants because it may impair the effect of the chemotherapy and therefore disadvantage you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the problem is there's absolutely no data that shows that. It's purely a theoretical risk. Because I feel that there is so much protective benefit in using these agents to help the rest of your body cells deal with the pro-carcinogenic effects of many of these therapies like radiation, I think that it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater a little bit to tell people they shouldn't support their health while they're going through one of the most stressful therapies in their life. And I wonder about the late-stage cancers that we see post-treatment of one cancer. It's very common to see a second cancer, particularly a lymphoma or a leukemia, show up in, say, pediatric populations who've been treated for cancer. In their 20s, they start showing up with other cancers that are clearly triggered by their first anti-cancer therapy.
And yeah, that's one of my concerns. That's
yeah.
What the doctor's talking about next is radiation therapy. There's new advances, I guess, in being able to zero in on a certain location.
Yes.
I'm hesitant.
Well, I think that things like the gamma knife and targeted radiation therapy make me feel very good because my attitude, if it were my body being treated, is that if you can use 3 or 4 crossbeams and get a lethal targeted dose of radiation by triangulation in my cancer, then that cancer's toast no matter what. And my throwing a few antioxidants into my bloodstream to save the surrounding tissue from getting a heavy, heavy hit is not going to interfere with the therapy. But again, for medical legal reasons, if nothing else, nobody is going to change their message about don't use antioxidants if you're getting chemo or you're getting radiation. No one's going to tell you it's okay. No oncologist, no radiation therapist, because then when your cancer therapy doesn't work, they can be blamed. I just don't think you're going to get a straight statement until it's proven safe, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to prove that particular thing.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've been getting these CT scans, I don't know, four in the last year, and it seems like I get really sick after each, especially the one I had recently. I'm thinking maybe it'd be better to talk to my doctor about maybe do the, he wants to do them every quarter, maybe every once a year or every twice a year.
Are they doing, these are CT scans, and are they doing it with contrast material?
Yes, contrast and IV.
Okay, well, if you're feeling really sick after contrast, I'm thinking that you may be developing a problem with the contrast. Maybe you should be thinking about going to a different technology. Perhaps ask if the cancer can be adequately visualized without the contrast, or ask if you could maybe get an MRI to monitor rather than a CT scan. Although the MRIs are more expensive, the chances that this bad reaction may build and be very bad someday is not negligible. It always worries me when people tell me they feel really sick after contrast, and I'm concerned about a complication that's going to build is getting missed, which is to say renal complications. And this contrast can cause your kidneys to shut down.
Yeah, different this last time. I did pretty well the first three times, and I've had a fever, chills, shaking. I mean, it went away after a few hours, and overnight I'm better. But
yeah, this is really worrisome, and you need to report that to your doctor and to the radiologist, and specifically request that they think up another method to monitor your disease. You don't want to push that one. That's not even discussing whether or not the CT scan itself is, which is giving you a lot of background radiation. It's the total body CT is like 8 months of background radiation. I think if you just do abdomen and lungs, it's probably about 6 months of background radiation. And your body's having to process that all at once, and you're doing that in a body that you've kind of depleted of antioxidants, at least if you're listening to your doctor and not taking vitamins and not eating a whole lot of fruits and vegetables. So I think that's foolhardy, and I don't like it. I don't like that that's being done to you, and you have to question the necessity. But sometimes you have to be the one to refuse, because the doctor has to follow the standard of care. That's his only safety net in this highly litigious society we've got. So he's going to do what everybody else does, unless the patient refuses. And if the patient refuses, he's off the hook. If the patient says, you know, that made me feel sick, I want you to find another way, or I don't want contrast anymore, or I want you to find another imaging technology, then the doctor's off the hook for not doing it the way everybody says you're supposed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need to take the doctor off the hook and negotiate.
Well, that's why I was calling. My wife didn't like the idea that I wanted to cut out the CT scans, and that you have to. Well, I don't think so.
Well, maybe not as often, and maybe there's another technology that will do the job. I think there is.
I'll check with him, see what he says about that.
You tell him about the chills after the contrast. He'll sit up and take notice to that, believe me.
Well, I talked to him last night, and I called him and let him know, and I called the radiologist, and radiologist basically said, or whoever I talked to there says, oh, that's not common. And the oncologist says, you're taking some stuff that really isn't good for you, and it is, people do get sick from it.
Yeah.
The contrast.
Yeah. I think that you may need to force them to take a little bit more attention to that and find an alternative. That's what I would advise.
Well, I'll talk with them about that. Thank you.
All right. And if anybody... thank you. Bye-bye. If anybody wants to take me aside out there in the oncology world and educate me as to why this isn't good advice, I'd love to hear from you, but I'm going to stand on my guns on this one. Let's go to Michael in Monterey. Hello, Michael, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Two questions about the lower back problems. I had surgery back in 1984, repaired L4 and L5. About 10 years later, I was in very good shape then. I was concerned about surgery, but the doctor said I'd be fine. And so far, he had been correct. He was correct. But about 10 years later, I don't know what I did, but I woke up one morning and I had severe pain, and it was in the pelvis area, and I found myself walking in a way where I relieved pressure on that side, and I was walking at an angle and walking on the outside of my my right foot. I went to a chiropractor, and he helped me with that after the fact. But the last 6 months, I took a job. I've taken a job that requires me to sit a lot more, both in the car and at my desk. And I'm having some of the similar problems that I had back then. And I was just curious if you thought it's time to go back to the orthopedic person and or the surgeon. And question, does that area deteriorate over years? Because I've continued to be very active since I've had the surgery.
You know, your surgery was at what spinal level?
L4 and 5.
L4, 5. Did they fuse you? Was it a laminectomy? Was it a discectomy? I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
They did fuse, yes.
All right. So here's the problem with fusion. If you think about the structure of the spine, it's a series of hinges, and each of these hinges has about, let's call it 15 degrees of play. And if you take 5 hinges and add them up, and each has 15 degrees, you know, you've got almost 180 degrees of freedom there, but they overlap. So
Right. Realistically,
we've only got about 110 in a healthy spine, maybe 120 degrees of movement across that hinge.
Right.
Now, if you take one of those hinges away, then in order to maintain the range of motion, the others have to bend further and wider. And so it tends to put additional wear and tear on them. Similar to the concept of if you have one bad tire, the other tires don't wear as well as they otherwise would.
For sure.
It's very characteristic for people who have this disease at one level to subsequently develop problems at other levels. After all, you had the vulnerability in the first place, and you've now put additional stress on the other tissues. So it could be one of several things. You may have another disc herniation, or you may have developed arthritis in the hinges themselves. That's called facet arthritis. So an imaging study will help tell the difference there. There's some subtle things we can do on examination as well. If you have facet arthritis, sometimes manipulation or acupuncture will do the trick and calm it down, and you're good for the next period of time. And sometimes an injection of cortisone into the hinge will buy a person relief for a year or two. Sometimes the combination of physical therapy and developing different abdominal muscles and these other adjunctive types of intervention, the chiropractic and the acupuncture, will get a person doing very well and not requiring any further surgery.
I have gone back to the chiropractor, and before this last 6 months, it has helped over the years. But this time it seems, I don't know whether it's the fact that I am sitting more in the car, and I'm in the car now, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
And I pull over to the side of the road. I'm not
good,
driving.
Good. I would just interrupt you to say, of course it's because your lifestyle has changed.
Yes.
But I presume that those are not reversible changes, and you now have to try and see if you can adapt to this new job circumstance.
Right. I have to, yes.
So chiropractic by itself may not be enough, although it was enough before. And certainly, you know, really good, solid program of 15, 20 minutes a day of core stabilization exercises that you learn from either a physical therapist or from your primary care doctor, if he or she is disposed to instruct you and able to instruct you in this. Doing those maintenance exercises, making sure that you have an appropriate ergonomic seat in the car, that there's enough lumbar support, that that's set up properly, making sure that at the desk where you work, everything is set up properly and that you have a chair that's designed for people with low back pain and that you get up and take frequent stretch breaks and do everything right. And then see if you can, by changing your habits, make up for the lifestyle changes that have sort of been imposed upon you by external circumstance.
So when you said imaging, you are referring to MRI or...
Not necessarily. I would probably start with plain films, given you're not giving me any symptoms like shooting pains down the back of your legs or weakness or numbness, which are the sort of symptoms that would make me want to get an MRI, because I don't order an MRI unless I think the person might need surgery.
I'm feeling it on the unusual side. It's my right side. The chiropractor said it's my pelvis. When I plant my right heel, I do feel the pain in that region.
That's not what I'm talking about.
I see.
That's not the sort of thing that would make me jump to an MRI.
Okay.
Sacroiliac stuff often will manifest the symptoms you're describing, make me think more of a sacroiliac problem rather than a disc problem, so it could have nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe your legs are slightly different length and putting a heel.
They are.
Yeah, but using a shoe insert could help. There are definitely exercises for that. They're called McKenzie's exercises. You can look them up online. The author is Robin McKenzie. He was a physical therapist who wrote a very, very good back exercise book.
Well, I've got an excellent chiropractor who did recommend those before. Over the years, I have been using those. I have become pretty lazy the last few years.
You got to get back with the program, man. Full-on program. And do all of those things before you start thinking about going back to the surgeon. Because I'm sure an MRI will find something that will justify surgery. The question is, not will it justify surgery, not do you have something structural that looks bad in your back, but is that causing your pain and does it need surgery? And unfortunately, surgeons like to operate. So if you've got an abnormal MRI and you've got pain, you may find yourself having that abnormal MRI fixed, but not getting your pain fixed.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't want to go under the knife again, ever again.
Well, if you need to in order to keep you from being paralyzed, I know you'll do it.
Yes, I will.
All right. Good luck to you.
All right, doctor. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. I had an off-air comment from one of my chiropractic listeners wanting to comment on the last caller. He said it sounded like the pain could be in the psoas muscle of the patient. That's a deep muscle that goes from the lumbar spine to the upper thigh, and it's behind the guts and the intestines and everything. So it's sort of on the other side of your butt inside your body, and it lifts the leg. I think that's also a very possible idea, Jay. Thanks for mentioning it. Jay says he treats that as a chiropractor all the time, and he thinks that that's a legitimate thing for the patient to do, and I hope that I implied the same. I do think that the symptoms described do not make me worry about an imminent ruptured disc that needs attention. And before we go to Cynthia, I want to tell you a little bit about a study that was published in JAMA in the December 29th issue of Journal of the American Medical Association. And this was a study looking at cancer incidence and mortality after treatment with folic acid and vitamin B12. And it was a study done in Norway, and they piggybacked off of a study that was designed to look at heart disease. And so they had a lot of people, almost 7,000 patients. And because Norway has national health and a good computerized database, they know, you know, who you are, what you took, when you got your cancer, if you died, whether you had your heart attack. They know everything. They've got all that information. It's just a wonderful research tool to have data like that. So in this study, people who had heart disease were randomized to receive 800 micrograms of folic acid and 400 micrograms of B12, or just vitamin B6 at 40 milligrams. And then they mixed it up. You know, some got just the folic acid, some got just the B12, some got placebo. They went back and were looking for heart disease data, and that's what the study was originally designed to do. But what they found when they reanalyzed was they did find a difference in lung cancer. In the people who got both folic acid and vitamin B12, there was a statistically significant, although not very large, increase in lung cancer. The relative risk, the risk ratio of lung cancer from folic acid was a 1.3. So there were 30% more cases in this large population of 7,000. The study did raise the issue that high doses of folic acid over the long term in older individuals might have an effect on cancer surveillance in the lung. at this point, I think there is reasonably good data to support the concept that you shouldn't megadose folic acid. And there may be some clinical situations, people with extremely high homocysteine, people with the MTHFR mutation, where the use of tetrahydrofolate is justified to bring down an elevated homocysteine and try to normalize a high inflammatory quotient. But in the general population, megadosing with folic acid is probably not indicated, and particularly if there's a smoking history. So coming down against megavitamin therapy in this particular area, let's go to Cynthia. Cynthia in Santa Cruz, thank you for waiting.
Hello, thank you, doctor, for taking my call. I had a hysterectomy of May 2008. They just took my uterus, not my cervix or ovaries. And my concern is I've been spotting for 15 out of the 22 months since then. And I was wondering if you might think that it could be that a few endometrial, harmless endometrial cells were left at the surgery site and are responding to my ovaries. Do I need to be worried? I've had two normal paps since then.
Okay, so they left your cervix. You had a partial hysterectomy?
Yes, okay. They left my cervix and my ovaries.
What was the reason you had the surgery?
I had a very large 4-pound tumor, fibroid.
A fibroid tumor. So prior to the surgery, you were not diagnosed with endometriosis?
No.
Okay. And you said you've had two normal pap smears, and that this is just small spotting, and it is cycling on the same 28 or whatever day cycle that your period's used to.
Yes. I'm 55, so I'm kind of an older gal. And it does seem cyclical. I was kind of worried because I was like, well, I don't have a uterus anymore. But I thought, well, maybe there's something going on. Maybe there's a few cells left in there that may be responding. I don't know.
It's a little worrisome to have bleeding after a hysterectomy because you can't be bleeding from the uterus, which would be the most benign site. It is possible that you have some endometrial cells. It's possible that you're bleeding from the suture line or that you're bleeding from the cervix. And if you're bleeding from the cervix postmenopausally, which, get your hormones checked and see how much estrogen's on board. But if the estrogen levels are in the postmenopausal range, that needs to be investigated. You can't assume that's benign. You could have, not to get too scary, but somebody needs to get a bright light and take a close look at the edges of the cervix, up where the suture line is. They need to do a pap smear of the vagina and make sure that you don't have, people can get cancer of the vagina, and it's usually a late disease, an elder disease, so you're a little young for it, but we do see it. And you could have cervical cancer that's just not showing up on a pap smear because the cancer's up too high to show.
So would that cause the cyclical spotting?
Well, that's why I want you to check your hormones, because I'm wondering if it's a pseudo cycle and it's just, coincidence and you're bleeding at intervals and it's close enough to every 3 weeks or so that it feels like a cycle to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd want to establish you actually have enough estrogen on board. Mm-hmm. Your idea about it being endometrial cells a little bit left maybe implanted in the cervix and those are bleeding cyclically, it's theoretically possible, but it is improbable. I'd say that if I had to pick probabilities, I'd say that there's another bleeding source, like I said, either a suture line or a carcinoma. I think you really need to chase postmenopausal bleeding a little bit harder. My advice would be to get a colposcopy. That's a study where the doctor will actually use vinegar or an iodine solution and wipe it on your cervix and around the top of the vagina and make sure there's no abnormal cells. And they'll also look all the way around and kind of behind the cervix and make sure there's nothing there.
Okay.
So I think this needs further investigation.
That's interesting. It could be suture, even though it's been a year and a half or more, it could be inside the surgery line itself or something tearing or something.
Precisely. And you're still sexually active, correct?
Yes.
So you could be occasionally tearing something. And one thing that does happen and will be happening with you is that there's motion of the uterus and the cervix and the pelvic floor go up and down monthly with hormonal influences. So if you have a hormonal cycle, I feel better about your bleeding, but I don't feel entirely reassured.
Okay.
I still think you need to find the source and
and
confirm that it's benign.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you very much. If I get more information, I'll put it out on the show next week.
Okay.
I'm going to go and do a little searching and find how common bleeding is after a partial hysterectomy.
Yeah, I thought it was curious, and I did do a little research about the endometrial cells, so I'd be very curious to see what you found out, and I sure appreciate it.
I'll look into it for you.
Okay, thank you, Doctor.
You stay tuned, okay?
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, I will. Bye-bye.
Well, we have an interesting little phenomenon out here in California. The state Senate passed a universal health care. It'll be interesting to see whether that's just more political grandstanding, forcing the Republican governor of a state that's really on the ropes budget-wise to veto a piece of popular legislation in the light of things stalling nationally. Ah, such fun and games at the political level at our expense. Well, I said we were going to talk about placebos a little bit, and a very interesting study also published this week. This is landmark research coming out of the Journal of the American Medical Association looking at antidepressants and whether or not they are effective, more effective than placebo, and if so, how much more effective than placebo. The answer in a very good, very large study is that if you have mild to moderate depression, there is pretty good evidence that a sugar pill works as well as the antidepressants in, you know, roughly 75% of the improvement can be attributed to the placebo effect, and about 14% of the improvement can be attributed to the actual antidepressant. And this is in large groups. So the first thing I have to say about that research is that if you are taking an antidepressant and you are feeling clinically better with your depression, please, please, please do not throw away your antidepressant and decide you don't need it. It is legitimate to treat any person with depression with a 6 month trial of antidepressants and try for improvement. And honestly, I pretty much am willing to accept that a lot of that may be placebo effect, but I really just want the person to get better. And I can't give them a placebo in clinical practice and tell them it's an antidepressant. That would be unethical. If I could do that ethically, I would, and see if they got better on the placebo, because the side effects are going to be less. But I can't do that. I have to use the drugs that are out there, and I use what I have. People often will dismiss my acupuncture work on pain, and they'll say, oh, well, that's just placebo effect. The patient's coming into your office and you're giving them a pain treatment, and it's very relaxing, and they, you know, get a lot of hands-on time and they feel better afterwards, and it's just placebo that's making them feel better. And my response to that is, wonderful. I'm so happy to have a way of evoking the very powerful placebo effect and getting my patient to feel better, because that's my goal. And one of the things that is very clear is that doing something will often, in a way, open up the natural channels for healing and feeling better. I think we have to remember as physicians that we are therapists and therapeutic channels first and scientists second. We can't use the Occam's razor of science to give ourselves an excuse for doing nothing. And I think when large government agencies, who particularly in countries where they pay for care, want to say we're going to test this and show that it has an improvement, I think that's a legitimate thing for large funding entities to do. But I do think when someone is there in front of you asking for help, it's your duty and obligation to try to help them. And if that help involves doing something that may be a placebo, as long as it works and the downside risk is small, I think it's an appropriate action to take. I'll let the scientists and the academicians figure out about whether it's just placebo or whether there's additional incremental benefit from the drug. What I'm looking at is low side effect potential, low risk of harm. And depression is a very dangerous disease to have. Anything we can do, even if it is just smoke and mirrors, that makes people feel better is a good thing for us to be doing. It's a little bit of a mixed message there, but the bottom line is, if what you're doing is working for you, please keep doing it. And after about 6 months, when things are stabilized and feeling better, you can try a withdrawal from your antidepressant. I think that's a very legitimate thing to do, but I recommend people treat themselves for at least 3 months if they believe they've gotten a clinical response. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.